This is Strat News Global. I'm Amitabh Bravi. And joining us from London is Dr. Avinash Paliwal. He's an associate professor at the School of Oriental and African Studies at University of London, as well as the deputy director of SOAS's South Asia Institute, and has written the book, My Enemy's Enemy, India and Afghanistan from the Soviet Invasion to the US Withdrawal. Dr. Paliwal, thanks for your time. I do know that you're giving us that little window in between your parental duties.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here, Amitabh.
Dr. Paliwal, just the NSA's visit to Kabul, Ajit Doval. Now, if I have my maths correct, I think he was there for the first time in his current tenure as an NSA chief, probably October 2014. Much has changed since then. 2014, of course, was when the US and NATO ISAF handed over to the Afghan security forces. India is continuously assessing the situation, right? And that would be part of what he's doing, what he was doing in Kabul.
Absolutely, Amitabh. This is a very important visit for a variety of reasons. First of all, this is a signal both to Afghanistan and the neighborhood, wider neighborhood, that India is becoming increasingly serious, both about the situation on the ground, as well as its own position vis-a-vis Afghanistan, and not just in terms of the postures, but also the kind of metal that it is ready to put behind its own policy posture that it envisions or the calculations that it is making. So the visit of the National Security Advisor, who we all know is one of the most empowered individuals in the current administration when it comes to issues related to security, foreign and domestic. So that's a very important message that India is sending at a very crucial period in Afghanistan's transition. So to that effect, it's a very important call. And I think you're correct in terms of the constant assessment that India has been undertaking about its own position in Afghanistan. The question that would be forefront in the mind of Indian policymakers, including the National Security Advisors, the Prime Minister's Office, the External Affairs Minister, is how long, what is the viability of the government and the wider kind of governmental umbrella in Afghanistan right now, which has been fighting for legitimacy, which has been fighting for survival against a very kind of systematic and a very organized Taliban onslaught. That is a question that the feasibility of this government would be very high up in the agenda, especially at a moment when a lot is changing, not just in Afghanistan and the region, but also in terms of great power politics, as we know, you know, the changes in Washington, D.C. and Beijing posture. Those are the kind of issues and calculations that Delhi would be making right now.
Now, publicly, we do know he's met President Ghani, Dr. Abdul Abdullah, Hanif Atmar, Abdullah Mohib, ex-President Karzai as well. He may have had other meetings that we don't know about. The whole plethora of the current spectrum of Afghanistan politicians.
Absolutely. I think it's very clear in the list of people, the list of officials in Afghanistan that you've just offered me, that India is very clear that India wants to cover all its political bases within the Afghan government. It's well known that the government in Afghanistan has a lot of internal fissures, has a lot of factionalism. There's a lot of internal kind of competition going on. And it goes right to the top in terms of the kind of political issues that we saw, even clashes sometimes between the supporters, between Abdullah Abdullah and President Ghani. So you can see that this government wrought with a lot of problems within. And no government, whether it's the government of India or any other government in the region and beyond, would be able to afford talking to only one faction or one kind of, you know, leader in Kabul. So I think the list that you have offered to me, it's quite a diverse list, and it shows that India is very clearly engaging with all the stakeholders that India views are its allies. For India, President Ghani and Mr. Abdullah fighting it out is not in India's national interest. It is not in India's strategic interest. So this is one way of New Delhi trying to tell them also to kind of reduce the salience of their own political infighting, because that's the only way forward in terms of having any sort of coherent negotiation strategy in Doha with the Taliban.
Dr. Paliwal, when you're talking about India's assessment, and of course it's the whole region and the whole world is also doing that assessment. But it's interesting when I saw your tweets, when you were drawing a parallel of sorts in terms of assessment, at least, and the situation to 1989, when the then RNAW chief A.K. Varma had also been sent by the then Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi to assess the situation of how much Najibullah was then in control of things.
Yes, I must give to offer two caveats before I respond to that point. The first caveat is, of course, you know, it's very easy to kind of draw historical parallels, but the context are, you know, the context between 88 and 2021 is different, and that must be appreciated. That's the one thing. Secondly, the tweet was unfortunately incorrect. I mentioned 88 in the rush of the moment. Mr. A.K. Verma visited Afghanistan on Rajiv Gandhi's request in February 1989. Not far from 88. But what Rajiv Gandhi wanted to know at that point from the then Royal Chief was how long, again, Najibullah's government would last, how long will the regime last, especially with Moscow having lost interest in supporting or doing the fighting on, you know, doing undertaking combat. The assumption, the ongoing assumption based on which Mr. Verma gave his assessment, and the assessment was that the Najibullah regime would last indefinitely till the time there is Soviet financial support coming in. The assumption was that the Soviet Union will continue that kind of political and military and financial support, even if it does not have troops on the ground, and that is good enough. He was correct in the short term, because till the time the Soviet Union did support Kabul, the Najibullah regime was in power. But unfortunately, he was ousted in a coup in April 1992, a very important moment in India's own history and presence in Afghanistan, if I may add. India was the main party which was in coordination with President Najibullah's office, trying to, you know, they had already supported the family. They were trying to rescue him. It didn't work out. Very, very unfortunate story. But today, I think a similar sort of question is defining, kind of featuring in India's policy circles about what is the viability of the government in Kabul if tomorrow this government collapses, whether it's because of its internal problems in combination with the Taliban military onslaught. How do we move forward from there? And that's a very, very reasonable, that's a very valid question to ask. And that's the comparison. I can imagine the National Security Advisor meeting the Prime Minister Narendra Modi and being quizzed about this, that, you know, are we putting our bets on the right horse, or there's some change that we must make sooner or later?
Well, one of those bets was placed on President Ghani after, you know, all fracas about the elections, etc. And I do believe Dr. Abdullah was not very happy about that. But that apart, since you're talking about viability, what's your assessment of the administration, the government, President Ghani-led government, especially since the Taliban, as you said, is continuing with its onslaught? And like in 1992, the U.S. is by the 15th down to 2,500 troops because of the Trump administration. And we don't really know about the financial assistance in the future.
So there are two or three aspects to that, Amitabh, the question that you asked. First of all, in terms of the U.S. involvement, incoming Biden administration, look, there is bipartisan, more or less consensus in the United States to leave Afghanistan. So whether it's 2,500 troops or whether it would be less than that, whatever financial package that they may or may not offer, none of that is going to be enough for the government in Afghanistan to outlast the kind of pressure they are in from the Afghan Taliban. They need more allies. They need more allies that would commit to their sustainability, to their survival in some very hands-on manner, and not just in terms of public posturing and support at the United Nations, right? So that's one thing. So unlike the Soviet Union, where no one foresaw a collapse, it's very clear the U.S. is not going to be there for a long time, even if there is a very serious commitment in the U.S. to the Indo-Pacific, even if in the U.S. or the Biden administration is going to look at this whole theater of Indo-Pacific from a China-centric vision. Afghanistan is not going to be paramount, and that's something which we have to kind of take it as granted. Having said that, now in terms of the viability of the administration itself, I think there are both push and pull factors here, right? There is a lot of mistrust, if I may use the term, strong term, within the administration as we know. President Ghani, there are personality issues. There is a lot of concern whether there is ample command and control being executed from the ARG right now in the negotiations. There is concerns about, you know, given the history of animosity, political animosity between Mr. Abdullah and President Ghani, how this would pan out. And there is also a concern that if all those interlocutors, whether it's Mr. Dostum, whether it's Ustad Atta, or whether it's even the Vice President Saleh, if they lose faith in the presidency, they have enough capital, both military and financial and political, to battle it out with the Taliban. If not as in the form of a government, but they can hold territory. And I think that is when we are talking about a qualitatively different scenario. It's not an impossible scenario, unfortunately, right now. And that is a scenario which we would basically be terming the situation as a civil war, where you have different, you know, kind of militant political leaders who are armed in their own capacities with private militias, who have their own international relations, trying to push back and secure their own interests, whether or not Kabul government survives. And right now, given the situation, I don't want to sound too pessimistic, but unless a deal, a sustainable deal is struck in Doha, that is a situation that is very likely. Just two very quick points on that. You earlier mentioned about the India's decision to kind of back President Ghani and that left a taste in with Mr. Abdullah. I think that was a very clear political call that India cannot afford to have that kind of dysfunction in Kabul. And that was also a signal to the United States that we cannot have this conflict between these two individuals linger on indefinitely. So I think that was, and India was the first country to actually back President Ghani.
Yeah.
It's very important to note that. The timing is everything here, right? So it's a signal not just to the interlocutors within Kabul, it is also a signal to India's, you know, partners, international partners, whether it's DC, European Union, UK, that look, we know where we are, which horse, so to say, we are betting on. So that is something that India has shown clarity of political intent, at least on that count.
And would there be clarity of political intent, like you're saying, with it evident about the U.S. moving away its focus from Afghanistan and the need for allies to step in terms of increased military assistance? Now, the reports earlier about boots on the ground when Mohib had come, I think, last year, and his office was forced to deny that. Well, that's one scenario I think you can pretty much rule out from India's side, right?
Absolutely. It's a terrible idea. I'm sorry to use that term. It's going to be dangerous. It's going to be a very costly deployment for India, which India right now, given the situation in Ladakh and elsewhere, given kind of mobilization in LOC, I mean, that's just not possible. We are already, you know, India short on its defense capabilities vis-a-vis its two neighbors with whom it has almost a two-front situation going on right now. So I think sending any troops to the ground in Afghanistan, it's simply a no-go. Also, it will lead to a lot more Afghan deaths because that gives Pakistan a lot more maneuver, space to maneuver, both politically and militarily. So I can easily, I mean, I've not seen any serious commentator, you know, advocating that in Delhi, even though there might be a desire among some sections of Kabul's decision-making kind of body to have that kind of a presence. But I think both sides are on the same page about this, that this is unlikely to happen. In terms of the other assistance that you mentioned about, you know, India strengthening, you know, offering more military support. Now, there are two or three segments within that again, right? We can easily rule out India giving heavy weaponry to Afghanistan simply for logistical reasons. Right. Even if you want to give that kind of artillery and all, the whole systems that go into having, you know, support systems behind artillery units, you know, the training that needs to be given, how to use it, whether to use it on the border areas, Pakistan, because Pakistan has been doing a lot of shelling. It's unlikely. It's just too much of a heavy lifting as far as India goes right now. So there is, unfortunately, a capacity issue when it comes to India's support that it can give militarily to Afghanistan. Yes, a lot of training, a lot of spare parts. It can also kind of offer financial assistance that Kabul can use given its own circumstances at its own will, how it wants to use that money to procure weapons from elsewhere. But I think beyond that, I do not see how much India can really do in this space. At the end of the day, India is a net importer of weaponry.
Yeah.
India is not an exporter. And I think that's the fundamental kind of thumb rule that beyond a point, India simply cannot do heavy lifting in that sector the way many other powers perhaps can. And I think it's important to realize the limits of what India can do, even if there is political intent to do more.
We talked about the plethora of Afghan spectrum of politicians that, say, Mr. Doval has met on this trip, and they have been continuous, even in Delhi itself. What about the Taliban itself? How do you visualize India engaging with the Taliban? We've seen the first official, of course, was the External Affairs Minister when he gave that video conference in Doha. And of course, the JSPY, JP Singh is an old Kabul hand, was leading the delegation there. And he met quite a few people there. And subsequently, how do you see India and the Taliban?
Excellent question, Amitabh. Let me go back a little bit to answer this question, and I'm not trying to go back as far as to the 99 Kandahar hijack, which I think is a very pivotal moment in the bilateral kind of, in the history of India's relationship with the Taliban, right? I mean, this is a moment when India makes up its mind about Taliban being a perennial kind of sort of adversary, even if there is also an increased realization that you cannot do without the Taliban or those constituencies in South and East Afghanistan, because India had no outreach with the Taliban in the 96 to 2001 period. Starting 2005, I think, when the kidnapping of Indian engineers, kidnapping of Indian citizens in Afghanistan begins in 2003, 2004, 2005, I think there is a stream of thought that emerged in India's policy corridors, which said that We need to better understand this movement. We need to perhaps at an unofficial level engage with this movement. And this is simply because we need to know what is the, again, the longevity quotient of the Taliban, especially if it is getting the kind of strategic sustenance from our arch adversary, that is Pakistan. Now, 2010, 2011 is a moment when India, at a very senior level, Indian officials decide we need to accept the fact the Taliban is not going anywhere. That does not mean that we need to officially acknowledge them and recognize them and give them kind of diplomatic legitimacy. But there was a very clear moment, especially when Mr. M. Kinnarayanan leaves the National Security of, as an NSA, Mr. Shivshankar Menon comes in. That's a moment of transition where there's a moment of transition in Afghanistan with new leadership, new intelligence leaders coming in, all of whom think that it's important to get gauge what Taliban looks like, right? That's a moment when we strike the strategic partnership agreement with Kabul. India takes one step forward of accepting the idea of talks with the Taliban, not treating it as a terrorist entity. A lot of Indian officials, now again, I don't want to take names here, but a lot of Indian officials who have been posted in Afghanistan over the years in different capacities have been reached out by the Afghan Taliban and vice versa. And this is something both sides have been trying to, in third countries or elsewhere, silently try to understand each other. What is it that you really can do for us? And I think there are two basic problems. Earlier, India was very reluctant to have a very serious outreach to the Taliban when there was a moment between 2011 and 2013, simply because it was concerned that would undercut or undermine the Kabul government in some fundamental ways, because that's the time when we were thinking of 2014 as the deadline of US withdrawal of troops, right? So India did not want to jump at that point in time, simply because it thought it's not very smart to do so. And the returns would be very limited. Today, I think that question about Kabul being, annoying Kabul or losing kind of face with Kabul, that's out of the window. I think Kabul itself would want Delhi to talk to the Taliban. And the reason Kabul, and they openly advocate that we are talking to them, everyone is talking to them. If India talking to the Taliban, generate some kind of pressure for them, for the other party to negotiate on a different way, in a different way, or to accept certain conditions that Kabul wants to put, maybe you should talk to the Taliban. So that element has gone. The second issue, but still, we have seen that India has not officially done that beyond these non-official. India has not really seriously considered that, or at least it's not seriously operating along those lines. That's first aspect. The second aspect is Taliban itself today, as it would have in 2012, it cannot afford to be seen as talking to India. Now, this is a compulsion that any Taliban leader, whether a military shura, political shura, sitting in Quetta, sitting in Doha, any Taliban official you talk to, they will very clearly say that, look, if we start talking to the Indians openly, then we'll have a lot of questions and a lot of costs with the ISI, with Pakistan. And I think that is a compulsion that they have not really been able to liberate themselves out of. So as far as I'm concerned, I would see Taliban openly talking to India as the ultimate litmus test of their foreign policy independence in Afghanistan. The day a Taliban representative, the day Mullah Baradar comes and says, officially, we want to talk to India and we want to respect, and we'll come kind of, be open to respecting India's red lines in Afghanistan, its sensitivities, its interests. That is the day I would say, yes, this is a movement which has matured out of the kind of influence that it has been under of the Pakistani security establishment. That's one thing which I don't foresee happening, at least in the short
term. Ian, we've briefly touched upon how India has been engaging with various Afghan actors. They've been coming to Delhi itself. There may be other reasons why they come here, maybe medical or otherwise. You saw Marshal Dostum come, you saw Atta come, you saw Saif come. Abdullah, of course, in his official capacity as well. So India engaging, I can understand with all parties there, so that you don't have all your eggs in one basket. But are we stretching too wide? Is our focus clear?
Yes, all of these people that you mentioned are part of the mainstream body politic of Afghanistan. I think our spectrum would have been too wide if we were genuinely hedging between the Taliban and all the actors. Mm-hmm. So as far as I'm concerned, all these people have a lot of internal issues. There's a lot of competition between them, a lot of kind of conflict between them. But at the end of the day, in the wider strategic divide, they are on site as far as India is concerned. They have, you know, India, and this is something that India has dealt with before. India has actually been quite adept at managing intra-Northern Alliance, so to say, the former United Front rivalries as well, right? There was a lot of shuttle diplomacy that Indian spooks were doing in the 90s, trying to get Dostumen and Masood not to fight with the Iranians and the Russians supporting that endeavor as well. Now, that is something India is fairly adept at. The success rate is questionable, but it's not always been unsuccessful. Let's put it like that, in managing these differences, if not always too preponderant either. Now, I think the real question here, again, goes back to whether India opens up with the other side, that is the Taliban. Then I think perhaps that's one reason why India has not opened up, because the moment you start doing that, one, you risk being seen as an opportunist, even if Kabul wants you to do that. Two, you might actually lose focus. What if temporarily Taliban starts giving you all the soaps that you want, and then turns around and, you know, backstabs you, for the lack of a better term right now? There's a lot of trust deficit as well, like accumulated historical trust deficit between the Taliban and India. I think, so that is one reason perhaps I can think why India is not reaching out to the Taliban. But the day that happens, I think then we can say that India is truly widening its net. And then we can question the focus bit of it, politically speaking or not. But till now, I think they're very clearly focused on one side.
Dr. Avinash Palwal, I could go on and on, but I think I'll leave all the other questions I have for this discussion for the other window that you will probably get a little later in your parental duties. Again, thank you so much for insight. It was a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much. It's an honor. I'm delighted to have this conversation with you.
And just a reminder for all of those who like our kind of journalism, you can support us by going onto our website. Do also follow our social media handles on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This is StatNews Global. I'm Amitabh Ravi.